You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you very much for taking this time out of your evening to be with us to hear about the Open Society Justice Initiative's work on ethnic profiling in Europe. And thanks also and our gratitude to the French-American Foundation for co-sponsoring this. It's a pleasure and builds on the work that they've been doing as well, comparatively on issues of discrimination and addressing it in both America and France. My name is Rachel Neild, and I am with Open Society Justice Initiative. I work on the project Ethnic Profiling in Europe. With me today, we've got René Lévy from Paris, from the CESDIP, the sub-institute of the CNRS, and Reggie Shuford, very welcome, from the ACLU here in New York, to give us a comparative perspective on some of the strategies that have been used in this country to highlight and try to remedy ethnic profiling or racial profiling practices as they are here in America. So let me kick off with a couple of just introductory remarks about the project within which we undertook this particular piece of research. As I'm sure you're all familiar with, Open Society Institute has a very long-standing concern with issues of discrimination in Europe, particularly with the treatment of Roma populations in Central and Eastern Europe. In the wake of terror attacks in New York, then in Madrid and London, we were also concerned by the increasing reports of discrimination in policing and counter-terror efforts that were targeting Muslim communities across Europe. I should say, I think more recently, building on that dynamic, we also see the impact of recession with even more sort of xenophobic and anti-immigration sentiment going on in certain countries. So while the specific factors that may drive ethnic profiling sort of shift with the political winds, the discrimination that's experienced by people of immigrant origin and minorities in Europe is very real. It is, however, until recently almost entirely undocumented in the law enforcement arena. There's been much more attention paid to issues of access to housing, employment, education, and health. But one of the challenges in law enforcement is that very few police forces in Europe outside of the UK actually keep records of their practices in doing identity checks or stop and search, stop and frisk, as we might call it in this city. And furthermore, almost no countries in Europe outside, again, the UK, keep ethnic statistics of any sort, and particularly in the realm of policing. So we went into an environment in 2005 when we launched this report where if you talk to, certainly when you talk to people of ethnic minority origin, they knew all too well what one was talking about when we talked about ethnic profiling. Police also were like, oh yes, we've heard of that. You know, the Americans have got a lot of trouble with that. But it wasn't visible in public or political debates. It wasn't documented, it wasn't quantified, and there was very little information about how one should address it. So we have been working with three broad strategies in Europe. We've, on the one hand, been trying to press for better and more specific legal norms that define and prohibit ethnic profiling and that apply specifically to policing. And there have been some very promising developments, not in hard law yet, but by non-discrimination bodies in writing about and recommending the need to address ethnic profiling. And in April, a report passed by a massive majority by the European Parliament, also calling for greater attention to this issue. The second strategy that we've pursued has been an effort to identify, introduce, and promote good practices in policing diverse communities. We were lucky enough to get actually an EU grant to work with police officers in Spain, in Hungary, and in Bulgaria, and with technical assistance from the UK, from the Home Office, from the London Metropolitan Police, and from the Leicestershire Constabulary, to introduce stop forms so that every time the police in the pilot areas in these countries stop people, they would give them a form and have a record on which they monitored ethnicity. In the most successful areas, we managed to reduce disproportionality very significantly. And this is great in terms of selling this to the police, the hit rate, that is the number of times their stops actually discovered an infraction or a crime, trebled. So when police use this focused, when they don't use stereotypes, they are way more effective. It was very clear in that setting. We're also next year going to be publishing a handbook on good practices, which will present research conducted in countries across Europe on the various initiatives that we've found going on where the issue has, to greater or lesser been recognized, and where police forces working with communities or sometimes by themselves have tried to do something about this. We found more good practice than we expected, but it is scattered, it's somewhat erratic, and there is not yet a good conversation going on across countries about what can and should be done. So the third strategy, and I'll wrap up and introduce the speakers that you've really come to hear here, has been to document the issue and to get the kind of reporting out that can to start to bring it into public and political attention. So since 2005, when we initiated this project, one of the things that we've done is a series of reports that tries to describe the shape, the dimensions, the extent of ethnic profiling across as much of Europe as we've been able to with fairly limited resources. The first study we did is called "I Can Stop and Search Whoever I Want." This is a quote directly from a Hungarian police officer, and he's correct. Under Hungarian law, he can. The study looked at police stops in Spain, Bulgaria, and Hungary. It was based on interviews with police officers, extended interviews with police officers, and focus groups with minority populations. What we found was a very strong influence of stereotypes. All the police officers had extremely clear stereotypes about minorities and offending patterns. We also found disproportionate stopping, disproportionate mistreatment of ethnic minorities. We also found that the police don't record their stops, they don't assess their effectiveness, they're not introduced into any kind of institutional management practice that any of the officers we interviewed could inform us of. That study actually was one of the things that helped us then introduce stop forms in those countries. So it was quite interesting, it kind of opened a door there for people to start working on it. We also did a major study, and these reports are all available on the chair at the entryway, at which we very strongly felt that when we do single country studies, we don't want to single out that country as particularly egregious. It is our sense that ethnic profiling is endemic across all of the EU, where there are significant or even sometimes relatively small minority populations. We did a large report called Ethnic Profiling in the European Union, which brings together all the information we could find about profiling in everyday policing, but also presents field research that we conducted in five countries looking at the way that counterterrorism had introduced new types of profiling of Europe's Muslim communities. And we look at the operational practices on the ground, the way in which identity checks, raids, arrests, surveillance, and the idea that you can identify people who are in the process of radicalization, the homegrown terrorist, through looking at religious practice and change in behavior and so on. So we look at each of these different practices in a number of different countries and found that, yes, indeed, counterterrorism had worsened and broadened the kind of police tactics in which ethnic profiling was prevailing. So The final report, which I'm not going to describe because Renee is going to describe, that we most recently brought out last June, is Policing Minorities, a study of stop and search in Paris. As you are going to hear, it uses a very innovative methodology, very innovative, particularly in the European context. It's been used more, it was developed in the United States, and has demonstrated, indeed, the produced statistics, specific statistics, on which groups are stopped and how much. In France, and you probably are aware, the ethnic statistics are a very hot issue and divisive and generally viewed as prohibited by the French Constitution and the Republican principle of equality. So this report, we decided to do it in France for a number of reasons. That debate about statistics being one, the way that France had come to public attention in November 2005 around the riots being another. The fact that France is a founding member of the European Union and a country that has a lot of weight and is visible in Europe. And France's historical track record and commitment in its constitution to principles of human rights and equality were all factors that led us to think that it would be really interesting to do this study in Paris. The tipping point for actually doing the study was that we found really skilled and super smart people that we could work with, because we knew that there was no way that we could actually just go in and do something like this as foreigners, and having the collaborators that we had was just a real pleasure. And René Lévy and his colleague at CISDIP, Fabien Jobin, I really can't speak highly enough of the work that we did together. It was a pleasure to actually do this research, despite spending many, many hours in the Gare du Nord, which is not a pleasure. René Lévy is the research director at the CNRS, as I mentioned. He also directs the European group, it's in French, Research and Norms, the GERN, and a number of other prominent studies and consortiums in Europe looking at human rights issues, at discrimination in policing, electronic monitoring, and he has written extensively in an excellent introductory article, if anyone wants, on the history of the French police. When René has presented the report, we're going to get some comparative remarks and reflections from Reggie Shuford. Reggie, we're delighted to have you here today, has worked with OSI US programs many times in the past, and I know he's a valued partner. He's the attorney with the ACLU in New York and leads the racial profiling litigation efforts that the ACLU has done, particularly here in the city. And I've got some more, but I want to turn to you guys.
Efficient.
And yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so Renee.
Okay, so I'll stand here because otherwise I won't see the screen and won't be able to talk to you. Okay, works. Okay. Well, thank you very much for being here, and also thank you to Rachel for her kind words, and for us too. It was a pleasure to work with Rachel and Indira and John Lamberth, who devised the original methodology of the study. Stops and checks we call them contrôle d'identité in French, identity checks, were known to be widely used, partly because there is a very encompassing legislation that allows them. I won't go into the details here of the intricacies of the law, but we can come back to this later with your questions if you want. there were, as Rachel said, they were not well documented in the sense that there were numerous observations and reports from through in the press and also by academics who had done field research in difficult areas, especially in the wake of the 2005 riots. But this is an issue that has a longer history than that. But there was no hard data, so to speak. Okay, it was a collection of qualitative observations. And so this study is the first one which tried to put some numbers on this practice. Now, the difficulty in measuring discrimination is that you need a benchmark population to which you can compare the actual stops. Okay, if you don't have it, you can't establish this difference that is significant between the population that is available for stops and the population that is actually stopped by the police. And as Rachel mentioned, in France, we don't have so-called ethnic statistics, as in Britain, for instance. And this is a very hot matter of debate currently. It has been for several years in France. So we had to devise a way to establish such a benchmark population. Now, there are two ways to do that, and this has been demonstrated by a study, notably by Waddington in the UK, is that you can start with the census data, if there is any ethnic data in the census. But this would not give you a very good comparison, because the problem with stops is that they're implemented in public spaces where the available the population that is present at any given time in those places can be significantly different from the population that lives in the neighborhood. And so it's much better to try to assess the composition of the population that's around during the day or during when the police is there, rather than the resident population. And this is what we did for the first time. This study was based on a methodology that has been devised by John Lamberth in the US, used mainly in litigation regarding discriminatory stops of drivers. You know, it's the driving while black thing. And this was transposed into stops of pedestrians this time, for the first time in a study in Moscow, in the Moscow metro. That was, 2005, Rachel, I think? And then later on, with some, maybe in a somewhat more sophisticated way in this Paris study, where we added a number of variables, of indicators, descriptive of the population, which weren't present in the Moscow study. The Moscow study already showed that there was, of course, very strong discrimination against visible minorities in the metro, probably more with higher numbers than we have in Paris. What we did with this study is we had this two-step methodology I've already referred to. In the first part of the study, we benchmarked the population present in selected locations, And then, having done that, we started observing on the spot the actual police stops by unobtrusively following police patrols or observing police officers in those locations and trying to record characteristics of the controlled people. Now, this is a very asymmetrical study insofar that we weren't interested in the police themselves. We might have done it. It would have been interesting, for instance, to look at the police's ethnicity, too, because especially in Paris, the police is more and more diverse, as we euphemistically say in France. But we didn't do that because it would have been too complicated and we would have needed additional observers to do it. And, well, maybe it will be for another time. So what we did really is look at who was being stopped. Maybe I don't have the time to go into details of the methodology and the preparation, but it is quite... what we did, the first stage was to train the monitors. We hired a number of younger students, basically, mostly women, because we knew that women were less likely to attract attention of the police and to be stopped, which was confirmed by the results of the study. Our main concern was to, in case was the safety of the monitors. We've had an incident with during our pilot study where we had someone who was doing the pilot study and who got stopped actually when the police noticed that he was taking notes. So we were very we wanted not to have this again with our observers. And so we took a number of steps to make sure that they didn't have any documents on them, etc. Another important aspect is, I'll come back to this later, but another important aspect is that, of course, you have to have monitors who are in agreement when categorizing the people, because they had to decide whether the people who were being stopped, of which ethnicity they were, and of course you have to make sure that they all agree on those categories and how you recognize members of these various groups. So we had to subject them to a test to make sure that they would record in the same way, and if some we had to eliminate a few candidates because they had they were too deviant with respect to recognizing people's ethnicity. Of course, we're not interested in the real ethnicity of the people, only in the appearance, and we don't care whether they're really black or Arabs or whites or whatever. It's just, and of course, there is a basic assumption, a postulate, really, in the study, is that there is that the way lay observers, let's say, lay monitors will categorize stopped people is the same as the police's perception of these people. Okay, this is a basic premise of the study. Now, to make the observation unobtrusive, what we had done, and this had been done in Moscow in the previous study, was that the monitors were equipped with phones, cell phones, without cameras, to make sure that they would not take any photographs, and maybe that the photographs could be then checked by the police. So very simple cell phones on which they would record their coded observations. They had to record 6, 5 in the benchmark phase 5, and then in the stop phase 6 variables. And so they would code them on their phone as text messages, which would then be sent out to here, I think, where they would be processed and sent back as statistics, statistical data to us and to John, who would with whom we would analyze them. There was another aspect to the study: is we tried to introduce some more qualitative data into it by trying to interview the greatest possible number of persons that had been stopped. That is, we had teams of two observers, and after they had observed one stop, one of them would go after the person and into a safe distance and ask the person whether she would agree to answer a very brief questionnaire. And again, not to have them take notes, they would record the answers. That was a very, very simple, and then call a voicemail server or recorder where they would record the answers, and this would then be processed afterwards. Just to give you an idea of the benchmark technique, we would place a surveyor or monitor at a certain place with and he would record persons who would cross a certain predefined line. He would do this every 5 seconds. Okay, he would record the data and then look up, and the first person he would see crossing the line, he would record. Again, all in all, there were 5 locations in the end, and we benchmarked, I think, 38,000 people, which gives a fairly significant sample of the population. Now, a word about the ethnicity of the people, the ethnic categories. We tested a number of categories. The idea was to look at visible minorities, and of course you have to have simple categories. You can't go into details like whether the white are of more Slavic appearance, for instance, or more of any other category. You can't do that, because this is also subject to debate whether they're identifiable or not. In the first stage, in the pilot study, we had Orthodox Jews in it. We had Roma, but in the end we realized that there were too few of those anyway to validly keep them. And even with these categories, we had to drop the 4 and 5, the 2 Asian categories, because we had too many cases, too few stops in the end. So we've concentrated basically on white, black, and Arab. These are the other indicators we've introduced in this study. We felt that the dress was an important aspect, because you have all these, it's the same here, but maybe not to this, I don't know if the extent is the same, but in France, juveniles have certain dress codes, or certain juveniles have various dress codes, which are clearly identified as what we call youth culture. So you may have, hip-hop or a baggy dress, or punk or gothic or something called tectonic, which you probably don't have here, which I didn't know before this study either. But fortunately, we had hired young people to do the study, so they knew about it. Of course, we thought that depending on how you were dressed, you had different chances to be controlled. And so we had three categories: business or some fancy dress, casual, and young. Then, of course, we introduced the gender variable, where I don't need to comment on this. I think age, basically, with young and old, again, these are very rough categories, of course. Young would be under 30, and old would be over 30. I'm sorry for those who fall into the second category and who see themselves as still young. But for the purpose of this study, it wasn't possible to be more precise, I think. Now, here is a sample of a few of these. Well, this is tectonic here. Okay. And this is, hip-hop, or don't know how you call them. This is mostly tectonic, I think. These are the... Of course, this is one of the locations. We are on one of our location here, and you have the police who are there very frequently. This is a location. It's called La Fontaine des Innocents. For those who've been in Paris, maybe they know the place near Châtelet-Léal, in the Châtelet-Léal area. And it's a place where young of various tribes gather. Especially on Saturdays and in the late afternoon, and meet, and they have all kinds of, well, there you see all the shades of youth culture dress. Another thing we thought was useful to observe was the baggage, because of course in the wake, especially of the London bombings, we felt that carrying a baggage might be a reason for a police stop, which is not true, actually, as I'll explain later. But so we had people carrying big bags or no bags, again, very straightforward categories. And then we had a variable regarding the nature or the outcome of the stop, either a simple stop, just asking for identity papers, stop and frisk, stop and search, looking into the pockets or the bags of the person, or a stop and the person being taken away. This is you may see it as a progression into the more from the less intensive to the more intensive stop, and the stop and taken away may also be taken as a proxy for the hit rate, in a way, insofar as only the serious cases or those who could not satisfactorily demonstrate their identity would be taken away, or if an offense was detected or suspected during the stop. Finding the right locations was quite difficult, and we did an extensive exploration of maybe 20 different places. The methodology imposes a number of conditions on the choice of a location. Of course, you need regular police presence and use of stops, which is not always the case. You also need the availability of a rather diverse population. Otherwise, you can't measure differences between the different groups. You also have to get places where the observers can stay for a long time, for several hours, without being noticed. And so there are not many adequate places, locations, and we didn't find many adequate locations in Paris. Finally, we choose a number of two areas: the area of the Gare du Nord, of the northern train station, which is one of the railway hubs and metro hub in Europe, actually. And the area of Châtelet-Léal, which is also a major hub in the Paris region, and both are hubs where people from the banlieue, from the suburbs, and especially the areas where of the more sensitive or difficult ones would come into Paris and mingle with the Parisians themselves. Well, this is an aerial view of the Place des Innocents. And in order to do the benchmarking here, could you come back to... Oh no, we can see it from here. You see, we had to post observers successively at all the various entrances of the location. So they would, for a while, at different... every day and at different moments of the day, hours of the day, they would move from one entrance to the other and benchmark people according to a fixed schedule. Now, it's quite easy on Place des Innocents because you have only six entrances, really. It's much more tricky when we move on to... the metro station, the regional metro station, which is a subterranean underground huge underground hall with this one has 20 or 25 entrances, so it's much more complicated because they have to go from one entrance to another according to a fixed schedule. Now I'll think we can move on a little bit to the results. Here you have the number of stops by location. In the end, we had a bit more than around 525 observed stops. I should say that so we had three spots in the Gare du Nord and two spots around Châtelet. One spot here was manned not by the police but by the customs. These are the platforms for the trains that go to Germany, but especially to the Netherlands, to Amsterdam and Brussels, and where there is, well, many people go to less now because there have been restrictions in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands, but this was a favorite way for people, you know, going to buy some pot, really, in Amsterdam and coming back to, and if you do that, you had better look like a businessman rather than the usual consumer. Okay, Joya. Well, this is a breakdown by ethnicity, and you see that we had very few Indo-Pakistani and other Asians, or not enough, at least, for the calculations we wanted to do. Now, if we look now at the results themselves, and we do this by using a statistical technique called odd ratios, which gives a probability of being stopped for each group according to its importance in the available population. Now you see that it's very much a gendered practice because. Now, I should say that if you are below one, if the odd ratio is below one, then there is very little effect, very low probability. If it's between one and two, there is an assumption that the variable has some effect on the risk of being stopped, and if it's over 2, then it's definitely an effect. And well, as you see, it's mostly men who incur a risk of being stopped. I think that most women which have been stopped in our sample have been were accompanying men who were being stopped, and but very few, I think, were stopped when they were alone. Then age, as you see, it's also very much the main risk is incurred by juveniles, and in some places it's a very high risk. That is, I think at the Place des Innocents, juveniles formed a very high percentage of the available population. I don't remember how much, but they were 99% of people stopped. Then if we look at ethnicity, which was, of course, our main focus here, you see that compared to whites, blacks and Arabs have far more chances of being stopped than whites. It's always, almost always, except here, almost always above 2, sometimes very much higher. We have no explanation for the differences between the locations at this stage, but I think the results are quite convincing here that ethnicity does play a role in checks. Now, things get more complicated when we look at dress, because as you see, youth culture is also very much a factor in of stops, or increases the risk of being stopped everywhere. And if we compare dress and ethnicity, the odd ratios for dress and ethnicity, we see that sometimes the odd ratios for dress are even higher than those for ethnicity. Now it's we've tried to disentangle those two variables, but it's very difficult because we have too few cases, in fact, to do a meaningful analysis, statistical analysis of this, of a logistical regression, for instance. But in any case, it should be said that youth culture is, in fact, what we've called a racialized variable, because, in fact, there is a very strong correlation between being dressed in such a way and belonging to one of those of the minorities, especially black or Arab. And even if the police looked only at dress instead of looking at ethnicity, they would, in any case, the result would be very similar, because if they stopped on the basis of dress, 2/3 of the people of the stopped people would be black or Arab. Now, just briefly, here the outcome of stops. Well, there aren't. The differences aren't very important between the groups, although you can see that blacks and Arabs tend to be frisked more frequently than whites and than the average person. And but the differences are more or less cancelled out when we look at stop and search. But when we look at taken away, then it's the black mostly who are the more frequently taken away. Now, the other interesting point is that if you look at the total here at the bottom line, the total of people taken away is 14%, which means that that's about one in seven, I'd say. Which means that 6 times out of 7, the stop does not result in any apparently serious situation, a serious either an offense or at least suspicion of an offense or of having, for instance, an illegal alien being checked. So, and when I said so, I think this is why I said it can be taken as a proxy of a hit rate, insofar that we might say that in the majority of cases the stop does not reveal any serious situation. Okay, well, that's it. Thank you. And if you have any questions.
Oh, we should come back up. It's gone, isn't it? I think maybe if anyone's got a sort of technical question, we could deal with it now. But otherwise, I'd rather pass the microphone on to Reggie. You do have a tech... Oh, God, I forgot. In that case, we need a microphone for you to... it won't get recorded if you just speak, sorry. While we get the microphone up there, I do... Not sorry, for the... I'd just like to recognize Indira, who's been running the slideshow. She and Renee wrote this report together and did a terrific job and made it through the editing process in one piece in the end. So thank you, Indira. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks a lot for the presentation. I was just wondering if you've managed to isolate the different type of clothing styles and see if there are some that are more frequently stopped than others.
No, whoops. No, we at this stage we haven't done it, but I'm not sure it can be done because I think there will be too few cases really to meaningfully to have significant results statistically.
There's another question in the audience. Oh. I don't know if you want
to just hold on to it. We'll show this one.
Hi, I'm just curious, along similar lines, there is a big difference, I think, between the French who come from the islands as well as the ones who come from Africa. And so I know that sometimes it's difficult, but sometimes you can go by shades, and whether that would be something interesting too, because I'm from the islands, I'm from Haiti originally, so when I'm there, they think I'm from Martinique or Guadeloupe. And when I met an African that was there, he said that, you know, they treat us differently because even the islanders treat the Africans differently. So I'm wondering, too, if it was possible to do something like that to see whether there would be a big difference of, you know,
no,
whether
how they stop. I think it's too subtle a distinction to be operational in such a study. It's mm-hmm. the same as, you know, trying to isolate, as I said, the Slavic whites from the others. Is
I guess sometimes they go by the you know, if you're very dark, they always assume that you have to be from Africa.
Yeah, but
there's another question.
Okay.
Thank you, that was very informative. My question was about the reactions from the people, because you've been talking about what the police do when they stop you, but then how do different people react to these things? And does it have in relation to your race, how you react to these stops?
Yeah, I didn't present any results from the interviews, that's right. Now, what appears is that, of course, many people, we asked them how many times they had been checked recently, stopped recently, and how they felt about it. And of course, a number of them mentioned that they were being stopped repeatedly, And depending on which group they belong, they react differently. And of course, those from minorities react more violently in a way than the others. But on the other hand, very few people mentioned that the police had been had do some give made some racist remarks or had been impolite with them, etc. Most people indicated that the police had been either neutral or you know professional or polite with them, which was very much noticed by the police authorities when we released the report. They concentrated on that result particularly.
Well, even racists can be polite.
Yeah.
You know. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't be surprised if people, you know, reacted, you know, in a way that was, you know, intended to not escalate the scenario. Mm-hmm. So that's understandable.
Yeah. So, Reggie, yes, on that note, let's pass to you, because I think where we are now with this French report is that building on the years of anecdotal evidence, human rights documentation, we actually have statistics.
Right.
And the report has received a great deal of media attention. There's a very lively debate going on in France at the moment. There's a new initiative actually by the Ministry of the Interior around youth and police. There's a recognition that relations have become so tense and problematic. Something has to be done. And so the question is, I think, for us and the civil society groups we're trying to work with in France is, well, what do you do? And what have been the experiences of some of these strategies in the United States? And what wisdom would you, you know, bring to us as we try to collaborate and looking at the way forward here?
It's a sort of big charge, but I'll do my best to address that. I guess the first thing that I would say is that I'm not at all surprised by the findings. You know, the U.S. does not have a monopoly on racism or discrimination at all. I think perhaps I missed in Renee's presentation what it was that is believed to have been motivating the contact between police and, in particular, minority youth. I mean, is it simply harassment? Is there a suspicion of crime happening? Is it a desire to contain certain populations? In the United States, it's largely wars that have been at play. In the 1940s, it was a World War II with respect to the Japanese internment. More recently, it's been the war on drugs with respect to Latinos and African Americans, and then the war on terror when it comes to Arabs and Muslims. But I'll also talk briefly about my own experiences abroad. Back in 2003, actually, Jim Golston from this organization invited me to Moscow to talk about profiling, and I thought, odd, interesting. perhaps it demonstrates my own ignorance or stereotyping on my own part, but I was very interested in who, in fact, was at risk of being profiled in Moscow, and had no idea even as I stepped off the airplane. Now, quickly after I got there, I found out that it's the Chechens and the Roma. And then I had an epiphanal moment, as Oprah would say, an aha moment. And that moment for me, and I don't know, it's not scientifically, you know, vigorously studied or proven necessarily, but certainly it's my own belief. And it is that, and it may not necessarily be novel, but it's that the darker you are, no matter where you are, the more likely you are to be the victim of discrimination and profiling. And that was stunning to me, given, you know, just the sheer number of people of color and those of African descent around the world, that would be the likely experience of that demographic was really kind of floored me, to be frank. And then in Paris, I was in Paris traveling in 2003, and I had some of my own experiences with profiling. And I think other people could relate to it. And I was, in one instance, I was at the Burberry store, and as soon as I walked in the store, the woman in the store came up to me and just proceeded to follow me around everywhere that I went. So even if I didn't want to buy anything, I ended up buying something. some socks, some Burberry socks. And then obviously that is consistent with even Oprah's experience, right? Remember in 2005, she was in Paris and she was trying to shop at that Hermès, I don't know how to pronounce it in French, store, and they wouldn't allow her to do so. So obviously, this stuff is not unique, it's not surprising, it's not any of that stuff. So fast forward to 2008 when I was in Italy for a vacation. And I recall three, I believe, explicit racial incidents. And I was traveling with my best friend, who's also an African-American male. The first sort of incident, if you will, was just us trying to flag down a cab in Rome. And we found it very difficult to do so. Unless we were leaving from our hotel, it was very difficult to get a cab. Another incident was similar to what happened in Paris, but in Florence, we were in a store trying to buy water or a quick snack, and as soon as we walked in, we got followed everywhere we went. And then finally, in terms of explicit sort of racial stuff, we were going from, in Rome again, going from one site to another, and we're trying to buy water, actually. It was like sort of an outside, like, coffee stand, and we were trying to buy water. And the proprietors were just having none of it. They were, like, not interested. They were like, you know what, whatever. And then we were persistent. We were thirsty, and we were persistent. And so they started finally engaging us, and the guy said, so where are you from? Africa. And I said, no, we're from the United States. And his demeanor changed 100%. So it goes to your point, and also points out that there certainly is, beyond sort of skin color, national origin discrimination that takes place as well. Again, not a surprise to anybody necessarily, but it one of the things that dawned on me is that the narrative that people tell, unsurprisingly, is certainly related to their own experiences. So when I went to Italy, last year, that was my first trip to Italy. And everybody that I had spoken to before I went to Italy raved about how amazing Italy was, the wine, I don't drink, but the wine and the food, and I was certainly looking forward to the food, especially. And but no one, not a soul, mentioned to me how one's experience might be different based upon their racial background. And so at a minimum, it's important to me to now have that be a part of any narrative that I'm participating in that discusses Italy, so that people can know and not be shocked. I mean, it didn't ruin my vacation, but it certainly impacted me in a way that caught me by surprise simply because I wasn't, like, expecting it. So that is that. And I thought it was important for the context of what you did in Paris and, other people's experiences. President Obama said something when he gave his famous race speech in Philadelphia in 2008. And what he said was that race is something in American history that we've never really worked through. And the reality is that that is an understatement. And the frustrating thing to me is that whenever there is the opportunity, perhaps, at a national level to work through it, if you will, there's such significant pushback. For example, in the Skip Gates situation in Boston, when the president dared comment on what he believed to be a stupid activity by the police, which I agreed with, that was the appropriate terminology and description, there was more outrage over what he said than what happened. And so what does that mean, right? It means to me that America really certainly hasn't dealt with it and really is not particularly interested in dealing with it. I don't know that it has the know-how at this point to deal with it, but it doesn't seem really sincerely interested in dealing with the issue of race. In fact, one commentator was reading an article just recently, and he said that unless someone is wearing a Klan hood while yelling the N-word and saying, go back to Africa, the charge of racism won't be believed. And it seems to be more offensive to the accused these days than the actual victims of racism. And I think there's a lot of value in that statement. Again, when people try to complain about racism, they're accused of playing the race card. You know, how dare you call somebody a racist? I mean, that becomes, you know, the issue as opposed to the underlying event. But America, as everybody knows, has a long and shameful history of profiling and racism, dating back to the Black Codes, when, following the Civil War, blacks were stopped whenever they were traveling from one place to another, forced to identify themselves and to identify where they're coming from and where they're going. And then when we think about World War II and the experience of the Japanese, it is clear that profiling is not a novel practice in this country. The ACLU became involved in the issue of profiling as we know it currently in the mid to late 1990s. And we launched a campaign against racial profiling in the 1990s, following some litigation that we had been involved in. Our advocacy employed a three-pronged approach. There was litigation, which is what I primarily work on, public education, which is, you know, designed to inform the public of the problem of profiling in this instance, but also individuals of their rights to not suffer in silence. And then legislation, which was designed to pass legislation that would illegalize racial profiling, that would collect data, and so on and so forth. And no matter what the manner of advocacy, there were three primary principles that we were espousing. Number one, that profiling is immoral, that it contradicts and is contrary to longstanding American ideals of equality and justice, that it's ineffective. The data that we had collected, and there was in fact a lot of data, demonstrated that many of the people that were targeted were in fact innocent, and that many of the people who were not targeted were the ones who were committing the crime. So that the hit rate, if you will, that Rachel spoke about earlier, demonstrated that people of color being targeted were frequently less likely to be engaged in any type of crime. And then finally, that the tactic of profiling is illegal, in violation of many constitutional principles such as the Fourth Amendment and provisions such as the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, Title VI, state laws, and human rights laws. And I would say quite confidently that advocacy seemed to bear fruit, that it was being well received by many, and that it was effective. Federal officials from George Bush to John Ashcroft were identifying and talking about racial profiling as a blight on the American experience, as wrong, as illegal, and as something that they pledged to eliminate. The reality, though, of that became a different matter altogether and also the general public had come to realize over time that racial profiling was wrong, such that 81% of the population said that racial profiling was happening and that it was illegal. But then 9/11 happened, right? So the Bush administration began singing an entirely different tune, and the American people followed. So that 67% of the American people began to believe that racial profiling was now, in the context of the war on terror, a legitimate tactic and technique to use. And indeed, that's what happened. Profiling sort of went wild, if you will, and certainly encompassed more than the traditional victims of profiling. So there was airline profiling, there was special registration, there was FBI surveillance and dragnet questioning, there was the Absconder Apprehension Initiative that prioritized Middle Eastern men for deportation on the list of everybody who had overstayed their visas, their border stops, immigration enforcement programs that resulted in profiling, such as 287G, there were no-fly lists, et cetera. And frankly, that profiling is still continuing in one degree or another. This is a recent publication that the ACLU did, submitted to CERD, called The Persistence of Racial and Ethnic Profiling in the United States. And so I don't really need to talk about the data, the specifics, other than to say that it certainly is happening in each of those categories that I identified. So as where we were making significant progress on the one hand at one point, it's almost as if we need to start again from scratch and employ the same techniques to re-litigate certain issues, to pursue legislation, and certainly to continue litigation, which we are doing. One of the things that has contributed to the proliferation and expansion and continuation of profiling was in fact a 2003 Justice Department guidance regarding the use of race by federal law enforcement agents. And if the Bush administration was serious about ending racial profiling, then this guidance did the exact opposite. It proliferated it, it promoted it. There are a number of problems with the guidance, one of which was that it didn't cover profiling based on religion or national origin. It only applied to federal law enforcement agencies and not state or local law enforcement agencies. It had no enforcement mechanisms attached to it. Excuse me. It had a large blanket exception for national security. This is post 9/11, and border integrity exception. So, again, the sense by advocates is that the guidance exacerbated profiling and gave rise and promoted profiling rather than doing anything to stop it. One of the things that still was never done by the Bush administration, despite many, many opportunities, was the support and passage of the Interracial Profiling Act, which is something that the ACLU and many advocates have been pushing for over the past several years. It's been introduced many, many times. And there's some likelihood that it'll be reintroduced over the next couple of weeks. There's an effort now to get co-sponsors for it, but there are a couple of things that the act would do, the legislation would do. It would compel all law enforcement agencies to bar racial profiling and to collect data, not just the federal government, and that it would require them to some degree to make uniform and the creation of procedures that would outlaw profiling. So I'll just stop there, but those are some of the, racial profiling continues to be a problem. Those are some of the strategies that we undertook. They were effective for a while. That changed when 9/11 happened. We have a new administration who's likewise pledged to prioritize the elimination of profiling, and we're hoping that we'll have a different response from them.
Thank you very much, Reggie. Although the lesson I take away is if you get to grips with this now in France, be ready in 10 years' time to get to grips with this again, which
yeah.
may be not the most optimistic conclusion, but I think realistic.
Right.
I'd like to just open the floor to any comments or questions that people have. And I'm sure actually it would be helpful, I should have asked before, for the speakers if you can identify yourselves.
Maxime Fersman with Justice Initiative, based in Europe and working on non-discrimination litigation. So I'm very interested by the topic of this meeting. I have a question to both speakers. First to René. The title of the study in French is very much different from what it's called in English, because in English we actually in the translation, I don't know, well, the English version was first, I guess, use the word ethnic profiling, whilst in
No, we translated it. It's called policing minorities. We couldn't translate ethnic profiling.
No, that's my question. And I mean, and in the French, at least in the French version, you're using minorité visible, which is like apparently you cannot even use the term ethnicity. It doesn't exist in France, or race is supposed not to exist in France because all are equal. So I was wondering whether we're talking here about racial profiling, and apparently it is a term that is allowed to be used here, and races are recognized as existent, and apparently this is not at all the case in France. I was wondering whether how at all you can cope with that and go into in France into devising in ethnicities. And I think, you know, you could be prosecuted for, you know, actually calling someone by a race. And a question for Reggie would be, you said that it is very difficult to litigate a case, especially because very often police would say, you're calling us racist, and, you know, that could be a crime, dependent obviously on the
system. That's not exactly what I said, but I'll let you finish your question.
Yes.
And then
my question is, I mean, what we're trying to do in Europe, and certainly with ethnic profiling, is we actually don't call the police, or try not to call the police racist, or say, because even if there are, like, if there are no circulars or indicators, you should act on the basis of race or ethnicity, then you cannot actually tell them. It's a practice. So then, I mean, the kind of language we use is, it amounts to racial discrimination, and then ask, is it racist? They say, no, that's not what we're saying. And it doesn't, wouldn't that make your work easier?
Perhaps, but do you...
I don't know, do you get the question?
Well, I guess what I was saying is that in terms of the national dialogue, as opposed to the litigation has its own challenges, trust me. And, you know, and it's sort of, it's very adversarial, so you can call them a prince and you would still get pushback. But in terms of the national conversation about profiling or racism, that's where I think it breaks down in terms of calling something what it is, right? And I mean, I think to the extent that using euphemisms to talk about the problem doesn't really advance the ball as much. I mean, I think one does run the risk of pushback so that the conversation breaks down automatically when you use certain language or terminology. But I guess my point is we can't really even talk about race, even if you're not calling anybody a name, even if you're simply trying to identify the issue. There is a breakdown, there's a pushback, and there is a tendency in my experience for people to try to come up with a million other explanations for why what happened, even when President Carter tried to discuss sort of the reaction to whatever President Obama does and talked about it being racist, at least by some people. He became public enemy number one. Barack Obama became public enemy number one when he called the Cambridge police, said that they acted stupid. He didn't even say that it was even racist, but essentially what they did, I guess he was essentially saying was, you acted stupidly, essentially amounts to racism. And then there was this huge pushback, such that it was, you know, seen as potentially threatening, you know, his agenda to get healthcare passed and so on and so forth. So my main point is that there is really a lack of will to engage race on a national level in any meaningful way. And I find that really, really frustrating. And I think that to the extent that your takeaway is that to the extent that, you know, the advocacy around profiling has been effective to some degree, that you may have to, you know, confront the same issues again in 10 years, I think that's going to be the case if you can't get to the underlying issue because people are not willing to really talk about it.
Well, you're right that there is, in the French context, there is much ambiguity about which words we should use to talk about these issues, whether we should use ethnicity or race or visible minorities, as we did here. Ethnicity is usually thought to refer more to the people's identity, but you might speak of ethnicities that are not immediately visible. For instance, okay, I know the Basque or the Corsican or, I mean, others. The Jews, for instance, if they're not Orthodox, well, they still may have a Jewish, you may attribute to them an ethnicity. Race refers more to the appearance, but then there is a debate of can we use race since we know or we are convinced that race do not exist. Now, Article 1 of the French Constitution says that no one can be treated differently because of his race, religion, political beliefs, etc. So there is an inherent contradiction in the constitution itself. We favored visible minorities here because what we were dealing with was appearances. And we didn't want to go into a debate on identity or on race. And we thought, now we're talking about people controlling, police controlling, checking, stopping people they can visibly, they can identify as belonging to a minority. And this is why we used visible minority. But I was, 3 days ago, I presented the results in France, in Paris. One of our colleagues criticized us for using visible minorities because she said, well, it's not... her point was that everyone is not visible to anyone. So that the police might have another take on visibility than the monitors or that the lay people, and so that if in a way, if we spoke of visible minorities, we might take for granted that there were visible minorities, so to speak. I don't know if there is a solution really. I'm not sure it's proper to France actually, because in Belgium or. The Netherlands, they would speak of phenotype to refer to the appearance. Now I think in France people tend to say ethno-racial types. So it's a way of not, you know, choosing between the various. But I mean, of course, the ambiguity of language reflects the ambiguity of the wider positions about this issue.
You know, can I interject something? I've just noticed an omission during my introductory remarks, and I don't want to be selective in my reporting of my own personal experiences abroad. In March of 2007, I want to talk about another continent even, I was visiting Senegal, and my college roommate was there on sabbatical. He's a white male from the U.S. He was visiting there on sabbatical with his family. He teaches at the University of Montreal in Canada, and so we were taking. They lived in the car, and we were taking day trips every now and again from the car to sort of travel out. And I forgot the name of this place, but it was a beach resort. And I was with my friend Bob and his stepson Jeremy, who's a teenager. And we were just sort of walking around looking at things. And all of a sudden, we passed by this sort of pond. And this white woman came up to me, and she said, I think in German, will you wash my feet? Suffice it to say that my response was not in German to her. But for me, the takeaway was like, damn, really, honestly, I thought I can't even go to Africa and get away from racism and discrimination. I mean, it just blew my mind. And she was deeply regretful of it. The look on her face. But it really is a really universal thing. And so lest we do believe in the states that there was some type of monopoly or creation of it here, then that is not the reality. And I think it's important to point those things out when you can. For what it's worth, I thought I didn't mean to leave that out when I was cataloging my experiences.
Thank you, Reggie. I think I want to jump from your point in that this notion of racial profiling has a risk factor that I think is I'm interested in hearing about as well. You get racially profiled every single day. So if, as a black man, if I'm wearing a suit and a white colleague is wearing the same suit and we walk into a restaurant and we're of the same age, chances are he's going to be perceived, or she, as my boss. And he's going to get direct eye contact, he's going to get the bill, a lot of things are going to happen. This happens every single day. But it's not a risky practice, but it is a profiling practice. I live in Ghana, to your point, the same thing happens based on perception of tribe or ethnicity or nationality. But what I've come to realize, being 48 years old and a big black man, is that there's a universality that being in the majority holds that has all kinds of assumptions with it. When most people are like you, then something that's other is seldom considered better and often considered worse. And so it seems to me that the research around profiling and the work around profiling shouldn't be about classifying, well, is this person ethno this or that, but really looking at the owner of the profile and what is it that in situations that you go through each day in your life, carrying, owning this, you need to do to check yourself. Because on the other side of it, I've been raised to check myself. I've been raised to dress a certain way. When I'm confronted by the police, I have to speak good English because that keeps me alive.
Right.
I know what I have to do. I've been told by my parents. So it seems like the work should be on the other side, not just focusing on what, you know, how do we further classify and understand and, you know, dissect those differences.
I very much agree with you. I mean, I think those of us, and I say us advisedly, and I mean, we're in a hegemonic culture when we're white, and we don't appreciate that because we don't look outside the sort of hegemonic assumptions, and the assumption is that the other needs to fit in with the hegemonic behaviors. And the degree to which that goes on is something that we don't perceive. I actually did a whole program called Seed, but whatever, which made me realize a lot of things that I hadn't realized at all before with a lifetime spent working in human rights. And so I totally agree with your point. I would say, to me, I think that's what Reggie is talking about, is this larger conversation about ethno-racism or whichever particular verbal construct, you know, that we come up for it with. But I wanted to make one comment, though, about terminology and profiling, because one of the things that we're actually really struggling with at the moment in Europe is trying to make clear that there are specific law enforcement practices that are what we call ethnic profiling. We're trying to use ethnic profiling as a term of art for when the police single out people due to immutable personal factors, things you have no choice over, for suspicion, where they just assume that Roma are thieving, that Bulgarians are trafficking, that, you know, the assumptions that go on, and that larger issues around, let's say, access to housing, discrimination in education, etc., these are forms of racial discrimination. But we're trying to say those are not per se ethnic profiling. And I think it's something that is not actually wholly accepted or even wholly agreed on. But I also think that there's something of a loss in terms of trying to get attention to this. If you describe everything as ethnic profiling, then it's harder to focus in on those specific law enforcement practices and try to engage directly with law enforcement about it. And as the French know extremely well, where they've done quite a lot of testing around people applying for jobs or trying to get apartments and so on, the kind of discrimination that goes on there. But there are channels, mechanisms, and laws that apply to that, whereas the law enforcement practices have really been ignored to date. So I think that's another conversation one has. I think we are trying to be quite precise because we think it's sort of strategically necessary to put this particular type of discrimination onto the table in Europe. Europe has some of the best non-discrimination standards out there, which explicitly recognize not just intentional racism, but indirect discrimination. I think some of what Maxime was trying to talk about, which is where a policy or a practice may not have an explicit racist intent, but it has a discriminatory outcome that can be very clearly measured against certain groups. And so because it is so difficult, and anyone who's tried to litigate this knows well, to say to a police officer, you stopped that person because they're Arab, he'll say, well, no, he was dressed like this and he looked at me funny and what's he doing in this neighborhood at this time? He'll always have other reasons. It's when you take the numbers, if you can get the data, that you can see that there is a systematic discrimination against people, and that is not objectively justified in the actual rates of offending that are detected. And as in the US, where we've managed to get the data, even in places where the stereotypes are incredibly ingrained, the stereotypes about Roma, gypsies, all being criminals, are so deeply ingrained. When we collected stop forms, we found that the hit rates, the offending rates, were absolutely identical across Roma, non-Roma. There's no difference, but the Roma has stopped 3 times more. So that's some of the kind of battle we're going through on. I think what you're talking about is the global challenge within which we've picked out a slice of a particular pie to try to address.
I do think your point is very well taken, and I was fumbling around trying to find an article that I read in preparation for tonight's conversation that really didn't make that point. And I don't have the quote, but it quoted James Baldwin, who said that the Negro problem is only such because of other people's foisting it upon the Negro, if you will. And that a large part of the reaction to President Obama, to put it crudely, is because he's actually stepping out of his place, if you will. So it's not that he's done anything other than defy expectations, that limited and narrow expectations that others had of him, that forced them to confront their whiteness and their entitlement and a lot of assumptions about talent and intellect, et cetera, and leadership ability, et cetera, that they are now having to confront because they have a black president. So the reaction is their issue, but they're forcing it on other people. So, yeah.
Sure. Why don't we have a round of comments if folks would like to come to the microphone, and then I'd like to get any responses from the table and wrap up.
Hi, my name is Amanda Wetzel. I'm a fellow with the Justice Initiative here. And I first had a comment and then a question. And my comment was, in terms of framing the context and how we talk about racial issues in the United States and France and the extent to which there are dialogue in both countries, I thought I'd offer also a personal anecdote. And that is, you know, I'm American. I went to school in public school all the way through college in the United States. And at every level of my education, I remember having explicit discussions about race. I went to law school in both the United States and France. And in almost every class of my first year of law school in the United States, we had specific discussions about race and racism and how it interacts with the law. There was not one discussion in any class that I took in French law school about race. And that kind of struck me when I was there, because I understood that there were real issues in France also, but that it wasn't being talked about in my law school, and I took the full general curriculum. So I think that when we think about these issues, that there is a real gap between the type of discussion that's taking place. At least I can't speak for the whole education system, but I can speak for the law school, and we didn't discuss these issues. So I guess given kind of that context, I think that there may also be a difference in the way community groups respond to these questions of racism and the way organizations might engage community groups in their advocacy as they seek to address the issue in both countries. So I was wondering if, Reggie, you could talk a bit about how you engage community groups and if there's a difference in the way that you've been able to engage, for instance, African-American community groups in your previous activism on racial profiling, and if you're engaging a wider number of community groups on racial profiling that is perhaps now impacting Americans of Arab descent also. And if there's a difference in the way those groups react to you and engage with you in your advocacy. Hmm. And then, Renee, I was wondering if you could give your impressions of what the existing community advocacy was prior to the report and talk about the way that groups are, or if there's any change in the way the groups are engaging this issue in France now.
Hi, my name is Lily Padilla. I'm a student at NYU, originally from Oakland, California. You noted that the majority of stops that happened in your study in Europe were of men of Arab or African descent. And what I'm wondering is how, if at all, you view sexual harassment of women of color by the police fitting into racial profiling and how that fits into your research in Europe.
Hi, I'm Tara Dickman from Humanity in Action in Paris. I just wanted to ask you about conversations, again, engaging with people. As René Lévy knows, it's very difficult to engage with police authorities in our country, who are tend to be very resistant to having any conversations linked to any kind of abnormal or unlawful practices, whether it's brutality, verbal abuse, or ethnic profiling. And I noticed here, for instance, with the Red Hook Community Justice Center, there really were conversations about how youth and police interact. And I'm just wondering, are there any examples of the U.S. Case of engaging with police authorities that we can take back to France? Thanks.
First of all, I want to apologize. Maybe I can't remember what I said, but when I was talking about my experience in Senegal, and I was about to use that like curse word, I hope I didn't say, excuse my French, because if I did, I'm very sorry, because that's not, so anyway, moving on. I can't remember, I do tend to, anyway. So, community groups and engaging community groups. It's not really challenging, because they've experienced it. They want our help as advocates and lawyers, et cetera. And so we're talking a common language of their experiences and how it's wrong and it's illegal and it's immoral and so on and so forth. And the question only is, are you, as a community member, interested in becoming a part of a lawsuit or some other type of advocacy effort? And either they are or they're not. I hope I'm not missing your question, but it's, and it doesn't, and the conversation really isn't different among community groups. It's no different when I was talking in the early 2000s and later on with African American community groups versus post 9/11 Arab or Muslim individuals or groups. It's not a difficult conversation. They're eager to have us advocate on their behalf and take up their issue and their cause. And so I hope I'm not missing your question, but it hasn't been difficult. That's not where the difficulty in the conversation happens. It's beyond that room. It's beyond your law school classroom. It's beyond this room. It's engaging people not necessarily with a common background or a common educational experience or a common set of assumptions that they agree upon. In terms of, and I'm sorry if I missed your question, but many of them come to us. Many of them come to us, number one. And number two, there are groups like the NAACP, if we need an organizational plaintiff that we'll go to in a particular state if that's where the problem is, or the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee when we were litigating post 9/11 airline profiling cases if we needed an organizational plaintiff. In terms of engaging with police, there are many examples of communities and neighborhoods trying to do trying to work with police organizations and law enforcement agencies to come together to solve some of the problems that they were having. And so there are many examples, and I can talk to you individually about that if you would like.
Sexual harassment of women by police. Well, obviously this was not addressed in our study at all, because, as I said, what we looked at was police stops, and as I said, they don't stop. They stop almost no women. So if there is harassment, it's in other settings, and not in these. I can mention that there has been a major study of gender study of policing in France by one of my colleagues called Geneviève Pruvot, and she's published several many articles and books on the also on the role of the place, the masculinities in the police, and the integration of women in the police. So maybe you might look at these works. Now about the change and the engagement with police authorities. That was one question. Another question was about possible change in the wake of our study. I think it's much too early at this stage to answer those questions. What we've seen, I mean, I've had two surprises in with the reception of the study. One was that we were never criticized for using these very rough categories, but nevertheless for presenting a study where we use these categories. I think probably 10 years ago it would not have been the same. So that shows that something in the debate in France about discrimination, racism, and the use of ethno-racial categories has changed. I had used such categories in my in the 80s in my dissertation. PhD dissertation, which was published in the mid-80s, I had shown that there was some, on the basis of cases treated by the police and the courts, that there were differences between in the way the various groups were treated. But this didn't raise much attention at the time. Since then, there have been several studies, for instance, on schools, but also on police that have used such categories in various ways. I think things are changing right now in France. Another surprise was that the response, at least from some of the police authorities, especially the Paris police, the Préfecture de police, the Paris police headquarters, was much less defensive than we expected. And less defensive than that of some of the police union representatives. Now, basically, those who criticize, for instance, the Paris police's spokesperson acknowledged the validity of our study in terms of, it's a scientific study and we don't have to criticize that. Now, of course, she said the police is not hired to sample, to do representative sampling of the population in its dealings with the with people, and we look at those we know are potential offenders. Okay, now police unions usually they say, or even I had a debate with a representative, a spokesperson from the Ministry of the Interior, and their argument goes, it usually is like this: first, your study is not scientific, since you've the locations are too specific, the cases are too few, etc., etc. Second, in any case, it's legal. And third, and of course, we focus on known potential offenders, and those happen to be Arabs and blacks. So that's the, but we'll see what happens. I think next week we'll, Rachel will come and Indira will come over to Paris and have discussions with various authorities in the Ministry of Interior with the and others. And well, we'll see. And also there seems to be a coalition building among NGOs who are interested in these issues to promote some changes. And apparently, at this stage, they seem to think that there are some openings on the part of police authorities. And we'll see. That will be in the next episode of the series.
Yes, indeed. I hope the next episode doesn't take a decade. Thank you so much, Reggie, for coming and providing an American perspective, and Renee, most particularly, for flying all the way here and being with us today. And thank you all for coming and spending a big chunk of your evening, and I hope the rest of your evening is equally pleasant and more relaxing.
Thank you.